Dearest nerds and gig lovers, I am Kirky, your gig mistress. This episode, I am so pleased to have with me Abaddon, original drummer from Venom, Venom Inc., Abaddon UK, and fucking Abaddon Venom. There's my demonetization gone within the first 10 seconds. Sorry about that. How are you doing, lovely? It's so lovely to have you.
I'm all right. Thank you very much. Thank you for asking. Thank you for coming in the house at this time of the morning.
And all right. Thanks for getting up and coming out this time of the morning. See, I made it look like night time. You gave it away.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the perils when you have kids. You just can't do things at normal times of night. And as I said to you in message, I can't very well turn up again to pick up my child from school slightly tipsy. So we couldn't have any drinks today, which is a bit of a shame.
Exactly.
Just next time we're in
trouble. You see, you can't have any drinks, but I mean, you know, there's always room for a small one.
Captain Jack.
Yeah, always.
Honestly, thank you so much for agreeing to do this, because it is such an honour to have you on. And I'd forgotten that we go back sort of without knowing each other. We've been in the same circle since I was about 16, which is longer than I would care to admit. Particularly sort of Moriarty and the Sith and sort of Guinea and things like that. We were sort of there, but never really met until face-to-face properly when I was at my uncle's gig not so long ago at Trillions.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if you remember, but we used to rob post offices together, you and me. So, yeah, we do go back a long way.
Man, we'll get arrested.
You got yourself.
I mean, how does it feel to be sort of sat there knowing that, you know, everything that happens in the metal and music, that side of music industry in general, you were part of that, you influenced that, you influenced the style of drumming, you influenced what is going on now, even to this day. How does that feel? Is that not weird?
Oh yeah, it's really weird, because we didn't set out to do it. I mean, we set out to be as heavy as we possibly could. We set out to be as over the top as we possibly could. We wanted to take what Kiss were doing on stage and make it dangerous. We wanted to take what Motorhead were doing with the volume and the ferocity and take it, you know, 10 steps further. But we didn't set out to be necessarily as influential. It was a long, long time later when I realized how influential we'd been. And it came about really because if you take the best way I can describe it is, if you take a band like Pantera, let's say, and then you take a band across in Norway, like Mayhem or Burzum or something, and you compare the two, they're nothing alike. They're not remotely alike. Yet both bands come back to Venom, and you can color in that broad picture. You can color it in with Sodom and Creator and even Anthrax. You know, you can put Metallica in the pot, obviously Slayer, Exodus, and it's a wide-ranging group of genres that are attributed to us. It started on an interview we did with a guy called Gary Bushell, who was basically a punk. Gary worked for Sounds magazine, and then he started working for Kerrang when Kerrang first came out. And he came to Wall's End to influence us. And he had the new copy of Kerrang with him, which had John Bon Jovi on the front cover. And Gary said, I don't understand what your band's about. I don't understand the music. He says, I come from a punk background. I work with guys who like heavy metal, Jeff Barton, Mick Wall, people like that. And Gary said, I don't get it. I don't get what you're doing. He says, are you heavy metal? Let's just say, are you heavy metal? And we went, I think I picked the Kerrang up and went, well, no. If this is the Bible for heavy metal and fucking Bon Jovi's on the front cover, then no, if that's heavy metal, we're not heavy metal. We're not nothing like that. He said, well, in that case, what are you? And we all shouted out, the three of us, we went, we're black metal, we're death metal, we're doom metal, we're speed metal, we're thrash metal. And he was like, wait, hang on. He didn't, I think he probably had a microphone, but he was writing all these things down, which became sub-genres of metal from then. Mm-hmm. And it just came from that one kind of angry conversation with a guy, and we just spurted out what was in our head, you know, black, doom, death. And if you speak to, you know, when he's... would look at interviews by people like Chuck Schuldiner and people like that, and they'd say, well, Death are the death metal band. He'd say, no, Venom are. And you can pick pieces of each of those genres from our music, from parts of our music. It's not that we're one specific thing. We're not just a black metal band, but bands from Norway and Sweden and Scandinavia took the black metal thing to their extreme.
Yeah.
Death metal bands took stuff to their, you know, doom bands took stuff to their extreme. So we put all that together. We kind of come up with all that just because of the way we were. Just we came from, as you know, we came from an industrial background in the northeast of England, which was pretty tough. You know, you had the coal mines. Your dad either worked in heavy industry, he worked in the coal mines, or he worked in the shipyards, and that brings out a specific type of hardened, toughened upbringing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what we brought. You were either good at football, or you know, you're going to get out of it by being a great footballer like Paul Gascoigne or somebody, Alan Shearer, or you were going to be in the music industry. And we were really lucky, because if you walked up Walls End High Street at any time in the 1980s, Neat Records was a tiny little doorway. But you'd see Fist and Raven and the Tigers and all these bands wandering up and down Walls End High Street, which is insane. You know, it's crazy. All these guys with long hair and whatnot, all just because this record company stumbled across this type of music. They stumbled across it. I say that quite rightly, because the first two Neat Records were kind of country related. They wasn't intended to be a heavy metal label, or you know, whatever it became. But luckily for them, certainly, and for us, that's exactly what happened. Back end of 79, beginning of 1980.
You've made some really important points there, because still to this day, I feel Newcastle is still a very hardened place for music. I think the bands that we produce now that we have coming out of the scene, they are still very raw and fresh. Take a band like Ellen, you know, who supported Raven. Raven were one of them bands at that time. That we are still producing that kind of, because we still have that very raw. We are still a very, as England goes, we are still very rough. Yeah. Not to use that word, you know, dramatically. I go places and people will go, oh, you can have a bit of a rough edge to you. And it's like, yeah, because that's what we you know, we are still very industry-based, or very sort of, you know, my granddad was a shipbuilder. He worked in the mines as well. That's what you were brought up with. You brought up with those stories, and sort of having the bands that we had, like Venom, like Raven, like Spartan Warriors, starting to come out and their influence, it's still all there. It still feels the same. I'll get to my point in a second. Neat Records was really cool, because like you said, it was there. It was on Walls End High Street. It was just there. It's not there anymore, but that kind of, we still have record labels in Newcastle. We still have recording studios. The same in Sunderland, we still have all of that. It's still a really big area for it, but that is something you guys pioneered, and that's really cool and really rare and special. And that outreach is, do you feel proud? Do you feel proud to be part of it?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I really do. Like I say, it's an accidental thing that happened, but you can't not feel proud of being part of it and having a handle in it. I mean, you're right in saying that we grew up with it. We all did. What really happened was, which happens with a lot of entrepreneurial industries, whatever you want to call it. Neat Records were having a penny pinch, same as anybody else, and they had a little 16-track recording studio. I mean, I'm saying little. The Beatles recorded on 4. But they had this little recording place. But as soon as we started making records, and Raven started selling records, and Fist started, they ploughed money back in. So it became a 24-track. It became digital. It became blah, blah, blah. So the bands were growing. The kind of mini industry within Neat Records and Impulse Studios, that was growing. Other studios were being able to set up. Fred Purser was setting his place up. Brian Johnson put money into Link Studios, which myself and then the manager, Eric Cook, were lucky enough to inherit. The money was being put back into bands. I feel a bit sorry for new bands these days, because there isn't that backing. You know, you don't get, you get a few, there are a few places like Biker Grave and people like that are opening venues, and they're turning venues into metal places, and bands are managing to get kind of three band bills happening. You're getting bands from Glasgow coming down and picking up local bands on that bill with them. So yeah, it may be turning, but after all the thing that happened with the lockdown and the COVID thing, the music industry took a pretty big crash. You know, I mean, some of the bands that are charging these ridiculous sums of money, you have to understand that for 2 or 3 years they were making nothing. Mm-hmm. So it's a weird time to be there. But I would say to young bands like Culloden, I mean, they're a bit of a favourite of mine. If you're starting out, just keep doing it. Just keep going, keep being original, keep being different, keep being yourself, because that's what makes you different. That's what makes people listen to you. Buy your records, buy your merch, you know.
That's it, though. You've hit the nail on the head. The music industry lost 2 to 3 years of its, you know, funding. And yes, that gave some people time to write, but also those people had no funding. And there isn't that much funding for it. Now it all has to be internet-based as well. You have to basically now be a content creator in order to be a band. There's no definition anymore. It's not like you said, like that support network's not there. I mean, didn't you tour manage? Did I read that somewhere that you did a bit of tour managing? Yeah,
I did. Myself and Eric were a management company, and we put quite a few records out by bands that were struggling a little bit. We had a good deal with a great company called Music for Nations, and we would put records out through them under our own label called Bleeding Hearts. And Eric Cook, who passed a few years back now, he was a genius, complete and utter genius, the man. Never off the phone, talking to bands, coming up with ideas, utter genius. And he knew that I preferred life on the road as opposed to in a recording studio. Mm-hmm. And the bands that we would put out, we would, especially American bands, European bands, we'd bring them over and do like a three band bill together, go out and hire tour buses and just go around and tour. You know, I looked after Nuclear Assault, I looked after Nasty Savage, the Crumb Suckers. And we had some amazing times, you know, some of these bands that came over from America, it was their first time in Europe. And they were playing some pretty big places. When you get into Poland, the Berlin Wall was coming down. You were getting into Poland, you were getting accepted into Russia, you were getting, you know, all these visas were turning up and work permits, and it was much, much easier. Since all the Brexit bullshit's happened, it's all gone backwards again. So I feel sorry for bands trying to tour now. Even just getting on a plane to try and go on holiday now, I'm hearing nightmare stories about people where the planes are cancelled and they're missing links with other flights and this kind of stuff. It's a nightmare. It's an absolute nightmare.
It's become worse.
We used to be able to, if you were British, I mean, you used to be able to breeze through airports and connecting lounges and this kind of thing with an EU, you know, passport. And now you've got to stand in line. Fairly enough, I suppose, you've got to stand in line with everybody else. And you know, people are missing their connecting flights and this kind of thing. So bands, you know, when you've got to take equipment, you've got to have carnets. Got to list all your equipment. It's an utter nightmare. I'd hate to be a tour manager now.
This is it. This is a conversation I've had briefly with other bands. The carnet, the dreaded carnet, and the cost of it, and the outlay just to get your stuff through customs and get yourself, you know,
If you think of a band like Venom, I mean, I couldn't imagine with Iron Maiden or somebody. If you have a band like Venom, we had three 18-wheeler trucks with equipment in, and sort of one driver in each truck. And if you go, it wasn't just one border between Italy and France. You would have a border to go out of France and then 100 yards and a border to go into Italy. And you had to be prepared to have all this paperwork and to know where every single guitar string was, every single drumstick, every drum head, every, you know, bass pedal. The driver would have to know where that was because the band weren't there. There were no humpers there. There were nobody else to help them do this. And you have to have paperwork in triplet. So you would have everything listed and you would leave it at one border, then you'd get it signed. And then when you came back again, we had to go down to an office on the quayside in Newcastle with all the paperwork signed at every border and deliver this thing to say that we brought it all back again, you know, and it's a nightmare. It's an absolute nightmare.
It's not. It is not what it used to be at all. It is. It's totally. This is a lot. It's actually putting bans off coming places in Europe. It's putting completely bans off from traveling and touring.
Yeah, I completely understand that. Yeah.
I think I was interested when I read the tour manager thing, because I think people don't realise the impact you yourself have had on so many bands and so many bits of the music industry. I mean, you go back, you look at Venom, okay? Venom were well received in Europe and America, but not in Britain.
No.
What do you think? Because I think Britain has a problem with receiving things. I've always felt this, like either a band will either take off really big, which I'll come to later on, or there'll be sort of like a really tough period of breaking the UK, same as America. Sometimes you can break America much easier than you can the UK if you're in the music industry. How did that make you feel if your home country didn't really receive what you were producing? How was that?
My take on it was that the magazines, the two or three magazines that were in England that were reporting on stuff, were not so much run by, but they were kind of guided by, let's say, people who either used to be in bands or wanted to be in bands. So they were, you could say, jealous, I suppose. I mean, this is only my take on it, but they were always championing other bands, especially American bands, and Venom were kind of ridiculed until bands came out that were influenced by Venom and sounding like Venom, looking like Venom, and then the music industry in England kind of went, oh, hold on, wait a second, this is a bit important. This is a bit of a diamond in the dust, you know. It's a bit of a something that's been there all along, up in that shithole in Newcastle. three loudmouth Geordies, you know. I can understand why people would look at it and just think, yeah, you're a pile of shit, you know, because they didn't get it, they didn't understand it. I mean, I was sitting again. I go back to Eric, but I was sitting with Eric Cook, and he rang an agency, a big agency in London. He spoke to a guy called Nick Peel. And he said, hi, my name's Eric Cook. I'd like you to come and see my band. Would that be okay? And Nick said, obviously thinking he has another wanker, you know. Would you like to come and see my band? He says, yeah, who is it? He said, it's Venom. Nick said, oh, I think I've heard of them, yeah. He said, okay, yeah, I'll come down. But, you know, obviously I'll come. Are they playing in London somewhere? He said, yeah, they're playing in London. We booked the Hammersmith Odeon. And Nick was like, okay, so who are you supporting? And he says, oh, no, it's our gig. We're playing the Hammersmith Odeon. And Nick was like, what the fuck? So he kind of covered the phone up and went, come here, and shouted at everybody in the office. You know, they all come home and go, this fucking band, who the hell are they? You know, what are they doing? They're fucking insane. But that was Eric. That's what Eric did. And he, you know, that I've always said that he was a fourth member of Venom. You know, he came from absolutely nothing, same as me. We both worked together as apprentices in Rayrolls in Heaven. As did Clive Archer, who was Venom's first singer. And Clive was one of the first people I ever saw wearing corpse paint. I mean, he was influenced by Alice Cooper, so you can see he was wearing makeup, and Gene Simmons was wearing makeup, but not looking that, trying to look like a ghoul.
Yeah.
Trying to look like, you know, the stuff that Mayhem took on, and again, Burzum and, you know, Bathory and bands like that. So again, it was just a case of being in the right place at the right time. I think that's a fair way to put it, really, and just being three Geordie wankers.
Who was having the guts to do it as well? Like, there's photos. I think there's one of you where you've got a skull on a stick and you've got your long hair flowing. You're like, ah! It was having the ability to do that, because, you know, walking down Newcastle High Street, like Wall's End, you know, in leather pants.
Yeah, I mean the punks and the skinheads, we used to get jumped on all the time. We you know, you'd walk through a group of punks and you'd get your head kicked in, and a group of skinheads, you'd get kicked to shit. And that was what was weird about that Hammersmith gig, was when we walked on stage, there were punks, there were skinheads, there were guys with long hair, there were hippies, there were old blokes. It was such a mix of the crowd. I mean, you talk about the genres that we supposedly pulled together, but the crowds were, I mean, I'm playing now and I'm going out and I'm seeing young kids and they get it. They get the history. They understand. They might not get it necessarily from Venom, but they get it that the bands they're listening to when they look at interviews and they read interviews, these bands are still mentioning Venom.
Yes.
And these kind of 19, 20-year-olds are turning up at gigs now with their uncles and with their dads and their older brothers, you know, and it's like, it's still happening. It's insane.
It's like my cousin having his little Venom badge on his coat, on his battle jacket, that. And you're like, yeah, this is it. It's still there. That's good, though. And I think that's really important because I think let's, you know, not forget that Newcastle pioneered so much. And I think this is a shame nowadays. And I'm going to ask you about this. I think the music industry is at a very weird place, okay? You know, there's a lot of touring going on and there's a lot of bands who are working really hard to tour. But I feel like Newcastle is missed out quite a lot. And I'm curious, this is something I didn't put in the questions to you, but I'm curious to know if you think why. Why do you think we would get missed out so much when we have such heritage, such good bands, such, you know, history, yet they don't really... We get the occasional band that'll play and then we'll get loads that'll drop off and miss us off the tours and tour managers won't necessarily book venues. Do you have any idea what your feelings are?
Kind of happened before Venom. You would get bands playing Manchester, Birmingham, London and Glasgow and Edinburgh and just hop, skip straight over Sunderland and Newcastle and Middlesbrough. And it's kind of gone back to that, you're right. I really don't know. I don't know if there's... Is it the money that they're being offered? I don't really know. I mean, I'm going up to see some friends at a Testament gig in a couple of weeks' time up in Glasgow.
Yeah.
They've done that, you know, it's a huge three-band bill. And they've done that. They're doing Manchester and Glasgow and then London and home, you know. I really don't get it. I don't know. I mean, there are certainly the venues to play here. There are the, you know, mixed-size venues that these bands could play. I don't really understand. I can only assume that there's not the money in it to come here. Otherwise, why wouldn't they?
I've got a funny feeling, like, from the bands that I've been to see recently, obviously this is my way to get back into the music industry. I had to take a step out of it when I had my little boy. I think sometimes when you become a parent, that's it. You have to take that step back. Sometimes you can't gel the two. To go back into it, from being a live music photographer, from being sort of a very sort of early 20s, to now sort of nearly 40, stepping back into the music industry, I see a huge difference. We have some amazing venues and we have some amazing bands and we have, you know, a poor turnout. Somehow, somewhere, there's a gap between these bands getting put on and we getting these opportunities to go and see bands to then a poor turnout. And I don't understand why. And I've seen it where, and I hope they were, and I'll not mention the band, but they had a sellout gig and then there was a poor show to the gig. There was loads of non-turn-ups, and it makes no sense when, you know, we have amazing venues and we have people coming to play. Then that band, is that band not going to come back because people didn't actually show up? Like, I don't get it myself. So I am asking these questions while I have the opportunity with the podcast, because, you know, this might not be a full-time thing. This could be, a, you know, an adventure that stops at any given moment for me. But,
I mean, I still have a lot of friends who travel to gigs and they jump in a car, they jump in a van and they go up to Glasgow, they go down to Manchester and they go all over to see bands. So it's become a thing where, you know, with me, I used to be at a gig nearly every night at the City Hall or the Mayfair because it was on my doorstep and it was relatively cheap, you know, but it was a good thing to do. It was like going to the pictures or something, and it was our thing. And you, every Friday and Saturday night, you get 2,000 people in the Mayfair, whether there was a band on or not. And then because you had that constant crowd, you get bands like AC/DC at the height would play the Mayfair. You know, the City Hall, they could have easily played the City Hall, but they didn't. They came to the Mayfair. Mm-hmm. And people weren't sitting in seats. People were up and dancing and jumping around and getting into the music, you know. And, but that, you know, the Mayfair has vanished and the City Hall isn't what it was. So maybe that's it. Maybe there isn't that kind of gang place to go to attract people and therefore attract the bands, you know.
like an actual, because Whitley Be Eye Shrink as well was one, and then the Mecca in Sunderland, Ozzy Osbourne yeah. played the Mecca in Sunderland, you know, things like that. That seems to be, didn't, the something in my head says that you actually played the Eye Shrink with Metallica.
No, we didn't, no. We, one of the first gigs we were booked to do was the Mayfair Newcastle Support and Fist, but we didn't do it. No, we didn't. We didn't play with Metallica. Metallica supported us on the first gigs we did in America,
right?
In Staten Island, they hadn't been to the East Coast. They were from San Francisco. They hadn't been to the East Coast, and they came over and opened for us over there. And both bands, we only played two nights. We played the Friday and the Sunday, and both bands kind of took off from there. You know, from that one thing, because a band from Newcastle didn't just go and play their first proper gigs in New York, you know, you just didn't do that.
Yeah.
And you certainly didn't fly over for two gigs and come home again, you know. One of the things we got asked by the bands that we did speak to, like the guys out of Fist and whatnot, they'd say, why aren't you doing the working men's clubs? I don't understand. We have to do that to make a living. And we were like, that's not us. That's not what we do. You know, we're going to set fire at the fucking stage. You know, like what working man club's going to take us on? You know, and it was that kind of thinking that it, and again, once again, to do with Eric Cook, it was that over the top thinking. You know, if Deep Purple can play Madison Square Gardens, well, we'll ring them up and we'll see if we can play as well. That was just the thinking. You know, that was the kind of over the top thing that Venom were. You know, and I still try to be.
I think you do, and I think you do with A Bad in UK, which I'll come back to. I think one thing I do want to know, is there anything you would change about the historic? And I don't like asking about that, because I don't believe in changing things, but at the same time, I am curious if is anything you would do differently with the hindsight and the experience of the music industry that you have?
Personally, within the band, I would have preferred that we could sit around a table and talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And I think the band, the three members of the band, had we have understood each other as individuals better, the band would have stayed together longer, and we wouldn't have been, we wouldn't have had that kind of stop start thing that we had. I think that was just from maybe being the Geordie boys, maybe we were all on our own pedestals and not able to sort of share and break down, you know, and say, look, I'm not getting this, how can we change it? But for the music industry, it changes, doesn't it? It flows, you know. I mean, I was saying before, when we were coming through, there were punks and skinheads around, but there were also all those the sort of glam bands coming out of America, you know, Poison and Cinderella and this kind of stuff, again Bon Jovi, that were having massive hits on the radio, you know, bands like Rainbow, who I loved, and Queen and Judas Priest were all trying to be on Top of the Pops, so they were all doing these poppy versions of their songs, which turned me off, you know. And certainly Priest kind of realized pretty quickly that they need to get back to being a metal band again, because that's where they were from, that's what they were about, and being on Top of the Pops might sell an extra 100,000 records, but it can also shatter your fan base, you know.
It's Metallica, the sellout Metallica thing. It's like when Metallica did the Black Album sellout, but even though it's still good quality,
it's the music industry and the way it changes, the way it evolves and changes. Is it better that people are using AI? Is it better that people are using drum machines? I don't think so. I think when three blokes or whatever, or three women get together in a room with stringed instruments and a drum kit and beat the living shit out of it and have a damn good laugh and a drink afterwards, I think that's a moment. You know, you don't build up to that. You don't come down from that. You are in the moment playing those songs. And if you're not, you should pack in. If you're just going through the motions, then just wrap up, take the money you've made and go and do something else. I don't personally think that AI has any room in art, be that drawn art or music art or dance. I don't think it's got any place personally. I mean, I guess the TikTok generation would disagree.
I'm with you. I don't like it. I don't like it. I mean, one of my favorite bands. They're very digital. They do use drum machines. They are a synthwave band. They're from Sweden. But their passion for what they do overrides any kind of. But there's no AI. It's all written from scratch by one person. You know, it's that. I think for me is how music is going with either they need a live set. Well, when they do it live, it's live. Yeah. So they can do it live. It's not that they can't. It's not that it's all written by AI and it can't be performed. It does have a bass and it's written properly and it is written with instruments. It is more how it's performed differently on stage. And I think if you merge the two, that's fine. But no AI, in my opinion, no AI.
Yeah.
And I think that can be really controversial. I mean, Venom Split, you were then in Venom Inc. for a really, really long time drumming as well, weren't you? Up until, I think, 2018?
2015, actually. Jeff Dunn, who was Mantis in Venom, him and the bass player, singer, Tony Dolan, who I got into Venom after Kronos left. They were touring as Empire of Evil.
Yeah.
And they were playing a festival in Germany, Keep It True Festival, and Oliver, who runs Keep It True, rang me and said, well, actually, they had played at a festival in Newcastle as Atomcraft, and they were playing a couple of Venom songs, and Oliver was standing at the bar. It was at Brofest. Oliver was standing at the bar, and he looked at me as if to say, why don't you get up and play? And I was like, I just shrugged my shoulders. I went, well, nobody asked. Fuck them, you know. So then when they were playing his festival in Germany, he rang me up and said, look, if I pay for a flight and a hotel and all your booze, would you come and jump up on stage and do half an hour of Venom? And I said, yeah, of course. What the fuck? I'd do that on a drop of a hat, you know. So we went over to do this ostensibly one-off. The crowd were gigantic. We were signing records for like an hour and a half. And Dolan's phone started ringing, and it was a promoter from China saying that I've just saw the podcast or whatever it was at the time. Will you come and do the same thing in China, and I'll pay you XYZ money and your flights and yada yada. We were like, so he came up and we were sitting in the hotel room, and he said, do you want to do it again? I was like, fucking yeah, of course. And then within 2 minutes, South America were on, and Japan, and then it became Australia and New Zealand, and it was like it just never stopped. You know, it was just full on. But at the time, I was newly married and my wife was pregnant. And I said, you know, I was in America. We were managed by John Cezula and Chuck Billy from Testament. And I said, look, guys, Rachel's expecting in March. Let's not book anything for then. I'm going to have to be with her. We've moved houses. She's away from her family, by herself. She was only just turned 21. I'm going to have to take time off, and that's the end of that. And I thought, well, that's a reasonable thing to ask. I left Australia. We were all good friends. I got back home, and they put another drummer in and booked another set of tours. And I thought, well, fuck it. If I can't take time off, I'd rather be with my family. So fuck you, you know, and that's how it is to this day, really. So Venom Inc. It was a great thing. It was a lot more touring than I'd ever done with Venom, which actually turned out to be quite good for my health, because it's playing the drums like that, it's aerobic, you know, it's good for you. And I really enjoyed it. I really had a good time. And I thought. Everybody was. It just turned out that when I needed it, I didn't have any support from them. So it was that old Venom thing again of not being able to sit down and talk about it. It is what it is, you know.
I'm going to ask it. Do you think now, if you could all sit down and talk about it, do you think that, you know, things could be repaired either or not? I mean, you can say no, you don't want to answer that, because obviously it's about not putting, you know, any pressure or anything, but I think
I think the original Venom, if they could sit down, the three of us could sit down, Kronos, Mantis and Abaddon, I think we could absolutely put it right. And I think we could be a band that going back to the conversation me and you were having a little earlier, we would be a band that people would support and would travel to see because of the kind of historic, okay, come on then, fucking prove it. Let's see what you got. What's new? What's different? What's so special about this band then? I think people would come to see that. I think older people, younger people, people in bands would come just to see what it's about, see what, you know, what everybody's talking about and what's been written about. So I think, yes, that band could. I don't think the members of Venom Inc. Being that singer in particular, I don't think we could sit down together. No.
Okay.
But I think the original band absolutely could.
That happens. Now, I'm gonna mention this, and anybody who's listened to my podcast will fall no sort of. I have told people off for mentioning a certain band's name on my podcast, but recently there was a, let me skirt around this. There was a very, very, very massive metal band, very, very sort of rock metal band, who have just had a film out, and on their red carpet, their front man wore a Venom t-shirt. I'm referring to Ghost, okay?
All right.
Excuse me, having a little drink there. So do you think, because now this frontman who's incredibly popular, a man of the moment in the industry, do you think that will have a really positive impact on Venom and Venom's back catalogue and things like that? That scene there. Well, it takes as a t-shirt, isn't it? Sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's absolutely right. When the guy from Burzum who committed murder was on trial, he was wearing a Venom shirt. And the amount of press that I did after that, specifically related to church burnings and murder and death and mayhem and all that went on in Scandinavia in those days, I did more interviews than I've done before that or since. So yes, you're quite right. Somebody wearing a t-shirt, whatever their political leanings or whatever their background or whatever they, you know, whatever they've said or been, you know, reported as saying or doing, wearing a band shirt can certainly, especially a band like Venom, because, you know, you see people wearing Metallica shirts all the time. You see supermodels wearing, I don't know, Exodus shirts or something, you know, crazy like that, or Slayer, because it's hip. You know, it's the thing to be. Okay, I'm a bit out there. I've got spiky boots on. I'm a bit out there. But yeah, Venom's a little, you know, even though we're talking about Venom at the moment, and you know, it's a bit obvious. Venom are still obscure. Mm-hmm. So somebody who's in a mainstream band going out wearing a Venom shirt, yeah, I think it's going to have some sort of an effect. I don't know if it's going to be positive or or not, but yeah, I'm sure it will have some sort of an effect. To think that somebody somewhere is going to say, who, you know, somebody like a I don't know, 17, 20 year old is going to look at that and go, who the hell's that?
Yeah,
I can't read the logo. What does it say? Who is it? Why is it a pentagram? Why is it a goat's head? Whatever. So yeah, it's bound to spark up interest, let's say.
And that's really important because of just what you were saying about how, you know, if you were to go, you know, and still now you yourself going on the road with Abaddon UK and Abaddon, fucking Abaddon's Venom. And I actually saw you on stage. You were on the triple bill with Spartan Warrior when I was there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was just... it was just so cool to hear it. You know, for me, I've been sort of a fan for a very, very, very long time. You know, I got my uncle to sign, he signed me CD, and which was hilarious because I was still quite young at the time. And obviously it's got, I'm not going to say it because I don't, but it's got a band on it. Yeah. So to have, to be there in Trills in Newcastle and to hear the stuff being played and to see you drumming, and it was so cool. And I think anybody who has seen that t-shirt on the red carpet, who then gets an interest, who then goes to see, you know, what they can get their hands on it there, you'd be surprised how amazing it is, you know. And you have just played this year you've had it, you sort of come back to it, haven't you? And you've started playing around a few different venues and supporting other bands again and coming back to it. So the list I had was you supported Satan and the Clooney, which I missed and I was devastated for, which was awesome. And you've got your massive drum kit, which takes up practically the whole stage. So you had that. And then there was Paddy Rock in Germany festival. How cool was it to play a festival in Germany again?
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. It was I'm lucky is that the fans who grew up with Venom have stayed with Venom.
Yeah.
And they're in their 40s now and they've got influence and they've got some money and they own their houses, they own their cars, they have influence with people who do these festivals. And they're always fighting in my corner, you know, they're always, there's always some link. It's not me, it's not the band, it's not necessarily the material. It's the network of people that have grown up with us and have stuck with us permanently. We're doing a full weekend thing in Trillions in July next year, which is just Venom related.
Yes.
And we're playing that, and people are flying in from Greece and from America, from Canada, South America, because they just grew up with the band and they just love the band, and the thought of all getting together again and just having one massive party in the northeast of England in Newcastle, and I'm going to take them round towards the end where Nick used to be, and I'm going to take them to the church hall where we used to rehearse. I'm going to take them to Tynemouth where the Rocks were, where we did that iconic photo session in the Helm. And we're going to go around and do photographs there and have a chat and have a laugh and tell stories and bullshit and just generally thank them really for the support we've had, you know.
That would be amazing. It's the, what was it? I've got it written here. Hail Legion Dries meeting. It's the 27th of July, 2025. Full Venom set. It's going to be a whole day in Trillions Rock Bar. It's a whole weekend. Yeah, it is. It's a whole weekend. I think the reason I've got that down is you're playing that day, aren't you?
Jim Clare's playing. He was in Venom. Anton Lance playing. He's going to jump up. You know, there are guests. There are people now who are learning some of the songs so they can jump up and plug in and just jam along and just see what it's like to get up on stage and play in front of people. The whole thing wasn't put together by me or by Dave from Trillions. It was put together by Michelle Pearson, who was a long-time Venom fan.
Yeah.
And he knew that if he put this out and mentioned it, he would get a response. And he's had a gigantic response. It's crazy.
It's going to be amazing. And I think this is what the Northeast has needed. I think we need to remember where this sort of music and where it was born. I mean, you have just played, I'm going to take this to Sweden now, you've just played Stockholm, haven't you, at there's going to be people who I have from Sweden are probably going to laugh at how I pronounce this. It was the Gammal Enskede Bryggeri, the brewery in Stockholm. It's like, so when I went to Sweden, no one could understand a word I said because of my Geordie accent. It was spectacular. Tell me a little bit about that, because that was with Blood of Jupiter and that was like a really special event. You had an Abaddon Brown Ale.
Yeah, which the guys put together. And what they wanted to do, they understood, which you probably will, that brown ale, when it stopped being brewed in Newcastle, tasted different. It's never tasted the same. Wherever you go in the world, they have the bottle, they have the iconic label, but it doesn't taste the same. And David Iceberg knew this, and he tried to put together something which tasted like when it used to be brewed in Newcastle. He fully understood, and it does. It tastes. When I was there, they opened the first cask to give me the first drink, and as he poured it out, he handed me the drink, and something about the colour didn't look right, so he poured the whole cask down the drain.
No.
And started again. Yeah, and started again. He said, it's not right. This isn't right. And he was talking to the other brewers that were with him, and he said, this isn't right, and it's because of this. Because of that, yada yada yada. So it took them another day or two to get it right to put it out to sell. It's being bottled now. I believe there's a brewery in Leeds have picked it up. So
excellent.
I did it again. There were a lot of lifelong Venom fans there, and there was one girl, Marianne, And I saw her, and she was practically crying. And I went up and gave her a cuddle, and I said, "It's fantastic to meet you again." She says, "We've never met," and that's the power of social media, because
Yes.
I've talked to her. We've shared stories about our children, school, bands, touring, yada yada. And I was convinced, and you were better than that, you know. And she said, "We've never actually met." I thought,
It's crazy,
oh,
isn't
no.
it?
Crazy,
It's
insane.
crazy.
You
I
really
mean,
think you know people as if like your next door neighbor, or you went to school with them or something. And it's just the power of music and social media. That's all it is.
the connection, some of the people that I've interviewed, I haven't actually met in real life, and it's not until their face pops up that that's when I'm meeting them. But it's strange, then I have gone to meet them at their show, and it's felt like I know them, even though
Yeah.
I've never met them before, and it's very surreal. But that is how it's working now, and it is that connection of music and connection and talking to people online.
Yeah,
I
absolutely.
have friends in Sweden I hadn't met until I flew out there, so I've never been to Stockholm. How did you
Okay.
find it? It's on my list. How did you find it?
It's a beautiful city. It's strange that you pass through really ancient buildings, with beautiful architecture and that, and then you're suddenly in amongst these really modern high-rise buildings with fantastically modern bridges and all this kind of stuff. And you're only kind of a stone's throw. You can see one from the other. It's not like going to New York or anything where there's, you know, great swathes of old stuff, and then you have to go and get on a train to go to the modern part. With Stockholm, it's right there. You can see it all from your hotel window, you know. It's great. It's a lovely place.
Because you were out
Highly
there, you were signing.
recommend it.
Sorry, Toy, what did you say?
Highly recommend it.
Highly recommend it. I'm gonna have to go. You were signing records, weren't you, as well? You went into a record store and
Yeah. Wherever we go, I try to give enough time to be able to sign stuff, and I give out my address to people when they have stuff that they've got signed by the other two members or one of the other members, and I'll say, okay, send it to me, and I'll sign it. I'll send it back to you. One of my favorite things is when somebody brings me an album that's been signed by the other two members, an album that we recorded in 1980. And I get to sign it and complete it. That's like it's taken 40 years or something for that album to be finally completed, but now it's done. It's that's it. You know, you can now put it away. You can put it on the wall. You can do whatever you want to personally do with it. But to me, once it's been signed by all three of us, that's a finished, done deal. And I love being the one to finish that.
how amazing is that? And I saw you signing like the albums and putting them back in the records. And I saw you sign, somebody got their tattoo, like this huge signature.
Yeah, it's amazing when you go out and you sign somebody's arm or something like that, and then you go and you meet them again like a year later on tour, and they've had it tattooed, and you're thinking, holy shit, that's for life. That's for life. You know, there's one guy, Mark Canapel, and Mark's got my face tattooed on his leg, and I'm like, shit, the bed, are you insane?
I mean, it's Venom and it's anything to do with it. Of course, it's insane. It's gonna go big or go home.
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly right.
So you've gone from sort of having a break, obviously, to then back to Sweden, Germany, playing in Newcastle. The new Abaddon UK album, All That Remains, was out. I'm curious about this because this is. There's a sound to this album that is, it's not, because obviously traditionally anything sort of Enemy has this kind of almost punky underlay, where this is more, it's more grit, it's more dirty. Okay, and I really like it. Any sort of influences behind this? And
I think the main influence at the moment with the band is the singer. Steve is a punk by nature. He still plays in a band called the Amazing Space Frogs, who
what a
are
name.
punk. Go see them, they're crazy. But he yeah, he's a music teacher in the university in Middlesbrough, and he teaches sort of 17, 18-year-olds, and he runs a studio, and he brings a lot. He understands what I'm talking about with my drum kit. We're working on a new way of recording at the moment, which is going to get us back to the kind of drum sound I want. And yeah, I think he brings a lot of that grit. And Dave, who's the young guitar player in the band, he grew up with Panteras and Sepulturas and this kind of thing. So when he joined Abaddon, it was a band. When he then looks at the songs he's playing, Welcome to Hell and Countess Bathory and Witching Hour, and he sees bands like Slayer have been covering these songs, he thinks, oh, hang on, I've heard this before. Is it not a Slayer song? It's like, well, no, Slayer covered it. You know, it's a Venom song. and now he gets it, you know, but he brings that grit from him liking those bands, you know, those kind of second wave, as it were.
Yeah.
He brings that back into Abaddon, you know.
Which is cool. And it sounds good. I like it. I like what I'm hearing, you know, because I think to fuse those two things are really important. And I think there's so many similar things going on at the moment. Like you say, there's a generic pop thing that's all over the place. You know, everybody loves a bit of a generic pop sound, and, you know, that's what the music industry is wanting. But when you get these underlying really well-written albums that have that fusion and that sound and that grit and the dirt, I think we're missing that nowadays in the music industry. I think everything's so generic. Yeah.
Again, we're going back to that TikTok AI generation, you know, you're going back to that. Everything's done on a laptop. And yeah. I still think, I mean, Dave Grohl said it, you know, he said that if you want to get a band, you need to get in a garage with your mates and you need to suck. You need to be shit, but you need to laugh about it and then go for a beer and then go back and do it again the next weekend. You know, that's what you've got to do. And that's what brings up, I mean, a lot of the great poets, a lot of the great painters, were doing it through adversity, and they were doing it through tough times, you know. War poets who write some beautiful stuff about, you know, how sick men can be, and you know how abhorrent war is, and having to go through that. It's lucky that we get to do it for fun, but we get to, if you get in a rehearsal room with Abaddon, you're going to know about it. You know,
yeah, especially with the size of your drum kit. My god, it's loud! It's loud. Woo! I want to ask you what, because obviously I can go into music and influence all day long. What are your nerdy passions? So, I do this for Nerdy Up North, and part of my thing is I want to explore what drives people a different way. What are your, I mean, you've got a really nerdy t shirt on to start with, so let's
that's nerdy.
The Exorcist, I love that film. Oh my god.
It's it's one of my passions, you know, sort of horror movies, even shitty horror movies. I just love that kind of stuff. I love that whole, I was brought up with that, you know, but 1977 when this came out, you know, there was nothing like it, nothing even close. And you were, when you're sort of 17 and you're going to the flicks and you're seeing movies like this, you know, it has a burning mark, leaves a mark, you know. It's like the Hammer House of Horror stuff. It's also Monty Python, you know, all that stuff in that time.
Yes.
That's been, I mean, people missed a lot of the humor that was in Venom, and it was because of Python, really, because growing up with John Cleese and Michael Palin, you can't not be influenced by stuff like that, you know. And it's all part of what made Venom. It's not just, you know, bombs because Kiss had bombs. It's not just a thunderous bass because Lemmy had a thunderous bass. It's not just big drum kits because Cozy Powell had big drum kits. It's all of that, all of the above and more. And again, like I say, the humour was a big part of that and still is. You know, that's how you live your life. You know, it's how you because we're lucky. Like going back to what we started with, where the upbringing of our father, grandfathers, and how hard they had to slog to get us to this date,
yes,
to this day and age, I think they'd be happy that we were laughing about it and enjoying it, you know. And that's part of if Venom's music's angry and it's over the top, yeah, it is. But then as soon as I'm finished and I'm having a drink with some of the fans, I'm not angry or over the top. I'm not furious. I'm having a laugh, you know.
That's exactly what it is. That's my motto as well. I like a good laugh. I mean, I am a Monty. I love Monty Python. I always have since I was a little girl. And it's things like characters like Tim with his massive head thing, and he's like, ah! And then you've got all the knights that say nay, and just the Black Knight, and you know, all those kind of things, and it being so very over the top. I think a lot of that is missed in a lot of some bands as well. There's a lot of nerdy references, a lot of different bands when you look. For me, when you mentioned The Exorcist, I didn't watch that till I was much, much older. And the first time I saw it was in a converted church. My friend was living in a converted church, and we put it on like a big projector, and it was the most weird thing. Because even now, it's not got the same bite, because we are so very used to that kind of thing being put in our face. But then, to start talking about those things and to bring in like Venom with the occult imagery, and even if it was there for show and shock, it was big shock. Now it kind of goes a bit over people's head, but it didn't back then. It was very, oh my word. I mean, I saw Hellraiser for the first time when I was way too young. Long, so I'm going to get wrong for this now because mom doesn't know this. Our banisters used to be able, if you snuck down, if there was a film on, you'd be able to watch it through the banisters without your parents knowing. So I used to sneak down, and I remember my mom watching Hellraiser, and that for me was one of those that was like, oh yes, love it. And it does, it leaves a mark and an impression on who you are. And I love that. I love that you can reference that humor to, in some respects, you know, because black metal can be so very serious, like you said, there's some very serious, but to have that sort of in there, I love it. I absolutely love it. And I do like that t-shirt. Yes. Is there anything else coming up for you, Harry? Are you going anywhere else exciting other than the All Deer in Newcastle, which everybody will need to check that out? I mean, I don't want Trillions too full, because I actually want to get in and I want to see this too. I don't want to, like, I'll have to turn up super early. What's going to be happening, particularly with new bits out, new music out, and everything that's happening with obviously a bad one's fucking Venom?
Well, the main thing for us at the moment is we've got a new rehearsal space in Newcastle, up the West End. And we're going back to a long time ago with Venom when we did A War with Satan and Possessed. We went and hired a stately home, Moor Hall, in Sussex. And we had a mobile unit outside, a recording unit, and ran long cables in, set the drum kit up in the middle of the gigantic dining room, and just kicked the living shit out of it. And you can tell the difference. And bands, I don't think bands have done that since, and it's what's something we're doing at the moment is we're oh yeah, you close mic the toms and the bass drum, blah blah blah, but you also mic the room, you also mic the corridor, you put a PA in the corridor, you put a PA in the room, and you put the drum kit through the PA as if it was a live situation. And you know, there are massive swings and roundabouts with doing this, and trial and error, and that's something that we're concentrating on at the moment. But the live stuff is still is still out there. There's a possibility of us doing Millie, who was Steve Grimmett's wife, is putting a festival on. Tyson Dougal sadly had to pull out because of illness with one of the lads, and I've messaged her and said we'd be very happy to come down and do that. You know, it'd be an honor, come down and do that in Steve's name. But yeah, mainly recording, mainly you know, writing new stuff and new ways to record, new stroke old ways to record. That's the big thing for us at the moment.
Yes, I think this is something that is really important. You've mentioned new stroke old ways to record, because there's not enough old school production now as well.
Well, I believe that. I mean, I'm still having a fight with Steve because, as I've said, he's a music teacher, and he teaches Cubase, which is, you know, a software program, and I want to buy a 24-track machine with tape, and he's, you know, we keep having this argument, and he keeps trying to convince me about Cubase, and because at the moment I can't find a good tape machine to buy, he's winning. So, but it's round the corner, Steve boy, it's coming, and it's going to be heavy, so get ready for it.
What you need to do is do both.
Well, that's what it'd be. I think what I would do is record, if I get the room sounding good, and I can get a good tape machine, is record all the drums under the tape, so you've got that warmth, you've got that old-fashioned warmth, and then you can take that away and put it onto Cubase, and then record the guitars and the vocals and yada 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 in the modern idiom, as it were. but once you've got the drums live on the tape, I think that's a starting block for me personally, and that's what I'll strive to try and do, you know, for the foreseeable future.
I love that. I do love that. I like all music. I'm a big muso. You know, obviously I wouldn't have a podcast if I didn't. But I think to be able to do, like I said, some people like to do the digital stuff exclusively. Some people like to mix it up, and it's okay. You can patch it as much as you want. It never quite sounds the same when you just do it digitally. So to have that hybrid fusion, and like you said, the drums are very important. I mean, like the way that you play and the way that it sounds is so, it's so good and it's so heavy and it's so raw. And I miss that sometimes about music, you know, as I think, you know, there's no, it's heart. It's all about heart, in my opinion. If like you said, if a musician's got their heart in it, then, and, you know, they work together. Again, with Spartan Warrior, they're very passionate about how it's wrote and how it's written and how it's produced and it's got the sound right. You know, I can't imagine Neil letting anything pass that isn't going to be, you know, sound absolutely the way that he wants it to. But that takes time and money and having a studio and having the space. Because even though you can have all these tools now, like Pro Tools and Cubase and Reason and all of these, you've still got to have somebody to bounce off or somebody to listen to or to produce, say, what do you think to this? Or a producer to a shadow, or, you know, to have been in the industry long enough to know how to do it yourself. And that's going to be amazing if you can do it and pull it off, and which you will.
That's right. It's about heart. It's about soul. You can tell. You can tell when the band are gelling in a live situation, and that feeds back to the people who are coming to see you, the people in the crowd coming to see you. They get that. It's not just 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 3. It's, again, in our case, three blokes on stage gelling and getting it right. And when you finish, it's like when you finish a track, you're like, you're practically grinning all over your face. You know, you're so happy that you've done a good job, and the people have been there to see it, and you've done it for them and for yourself, and it's trying, in my case, trying to get that in the studio on record as well, you know.
Yeah, to have so that feel.
But when you play it, people these days are going back to buying vinyl again because they understand the difference between listening on your phone or listening in the car or listening on CD. Or tape. It's just not the same as putting a vinyl record on and looking at the sleeve and looking at the artwork that the guitarist or the drummer or whoever's done, and the logo, the work that's gone in the logo and the photographs on the back and the lyrics on the inside and the poster that's in there. It's a huge thing that we all had when we were kind of growing up, that I think the generation, the part of the generation that listens to this type of music or this genre, as it were, I think that they get it. I think they absolutely get it, you know.
I get that. I see that happening. The vinyl has massively increased. I mean, I'm back of the day when sort of I used to take my money and go to the Hot Rat Records in Sunderland. I used to get my wage packet in a packet, and I used to go to Hot Rats and I used to buy a vinyl. It would be a Sisters of Mercy one. I remember getting one and it having a pull-out poster, and it being the best day of my life that it had this pull-out poster, and it was massive. It was a huge poster and it went straight on my wall. Blue Tack, so it's ruined now, but Blue Tack straight on the wall, like that. You don't get that with all this digital stuff.
No.
You just don't get the feel. And nothing to sign. Like, I like to get things signed all the time, yeah, and like you said.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, lastly, because I always ask this and it can land me in all sorts of trouble. I always ask if there's anything you want to ask me. Now, this I'll give an honest answer. I've been challenged, so I've eaten fire. I've been in a mosh pit thanks to Ellen from Ellen, which was spectacular because I'm a very dainty, delicate human being, and I got battered from pillar to post. Eating fire was fantastic. I still do it, but it's very dangerous, and I have very blonde hair that is very easy to catch on fire, hence why, yeah, I've got a bit missing. Is there anything you want to ask me at all?
What a
say
weird...
no.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll have a think about it and I'll text you it.
Okay.
I'll have a think about something daft.
Okay. Not do. A problem at all. I like that. We'll keep it for later on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Honestly, thank you, Abaddon, for taking the time to come on with me and talk about it. It is because it's fascinating to be able to get to sit and talk to you about it and to see the roots and see where you're going yourself. Because I think for all bands, you know, split, it's still to remember that each member of the band has their own things generally going on or goes forward in their own particular way. And, you know, I will do everything I possibly can to get to the Hail Legends Rise meeting. I will, you know, short of not being able to get out of bed, I'll be there, you know.
I can guarantee if you do, you'll enjoy it. You'll enjoy not necessarily the music. Well, you probably would like music, but I think you'll enjoy meeting people and hearing their stories and seeing that click of people who don't even speak each other's languages necessarily. You know, the one thing they've got in common is three wankers from Newcastle.
I will love it, and I hope I get to see you play and just generally around in Trillions. I think we should have a proper drink.
Absolutely. Next one's on me.
Yay! I'll accept that. Thank you, Abaddon. Thank you for your time. You have a lovely afternoon, right? You take care of yourself.
You too. Thanks so
much. Over and out. Gigs up north. Bye-bye.